The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
If you're not willing to roll up your sleeves and sit on the kitchen floor of your client's house and understand who your client is and really feel that in your heart and then outwork everyone else, then you should not be a trial lawyer.
Mike Hager talks about the lessons he's learned from the Dean of Torts, J.B. Spence, and some of the high-stakes cases he's handled in his career.
When that jury was out, all you're thinking about is the flip side. If I lose this case, he's going to die. His life is literally in my hands.
And the importance of the Florida Justice Association in his legal practice.
If you have the privilege to stand up in a courtroom and represent a client, then you have the responsibility to go to the legislature and fight for those clients' rights. You know, without the FJA, we wouldn't have a legal practice. We would not have a tort system in the state of Florida.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Having a father who was a well-known and successful trial lawyer didn't mean Mike Haggard was on easy street. His interest in practicing law first came from his dad, Andy, but Mike had to work hard. He had no success in repeated testimony before the Federal Consumer Product Safety Commission on swimming pool safety. But he didn't give up. He found a unique opportunity to finally make the kind of lasting policy change that all trial lawyers hope for. Swimming pools are safer today because of the results he achieved. While he and his Coral Gables firm focus on representing injured clients, Mike devotes significant time to proactive efforts to avoid injuries and deaths, speaking to corporate groups on how to improve safety for consumers. Mike Haggard sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in May of 2020 to talk about the ongoing relationships with clients that have sustained his career, how the trial bar and the business community can successfully coexist, and the link between coaching youth football and trial law.
Mike, your personal injury practice has found a specialization in pool drowning. Drowning is the leading cause of death for youngsters here in Florida and in some other states. You've had some very significant success, two almost back-to-back cases with verdicts of $100 million plus each. How did you get into that specialty? And tell us a bit about those cases.
Well, you know, we had handled some drowning cases before, unfortunately, involving children. And in June of 2000, Lorenzo Peterson was a 14-year-old boy who was swimming in an apartment complex with his friend, Tony Boudreau. And they were doing what we've all done as kids, throwing pennies down to the bottom of the pool and going down and getting them as they would slowly go towards the suction at the bottom of the drain of the pool. And unfortunately, that pool drain had been missing for several years at this apartment complex. And Lorenzo had put his hand in there and got stuck in the drain opening. And it was just a tragedy of unbelievable proportions. I mean, his friend Tony was trying to pull Lorenzo up as others jumped in the pool to assist him. I'll never forget, there were two folks who worked for a moving company that were moving a lady into the apartment. And they jumped in and they described on the witness stand a couple years later in trial, looking in Lorenzo's eyes as he became unconscious. And that case really, you know, caught the headlines in Miami of how could this happen to a strong 14-year-old boy with five to six people jumping in the pool, trying to pull him out with a human chain. Even went to the extent of cutting a hose and trying to get oxygen to Lorenzo. And he wasn't freed until a police officer broke into the pool pump room and turned off the pump. And, you know, we got involved in that case and realized that this is a huge problem and had been going on for decades, where children and even adults have been getting stuck on pool drains, young girls getting their hair entangled into suction outlets, and even children sitting on drains and becoming eviscerated, disemboweled. And this has been occurring with all different types of pool pumps and pool drains. And so when we got involved in that case, it wasn't just about one case. It was about this problem that had been going on, and really nothing had been done about it by the CPSC and by other government agencies, even though they knew this was going on. And certainly nothing was being done by the pool industry, who really kind of just swept this under the rug. I'm talking about 30, 40 different kids have been killed by the same mechanism. It was really a sad and tragic case.
Now, that was a $104 million verdict. It was the largest single personal injury jury verdict in Florida at the time. And it was a rather quick verdict, wasn't it?
It was. You know, it was crazy how that year went, because we had previously tried Lauren Hinton's case, who was a young girl, went through a broken pool gate. And we tried those cases, as you mentioned, back to back in 2003. And one was a $101 million verdict, Lauren Hinton, and then Lorenzo Peterson later that year for $104 million. And both were pool cases, ironically, with terribly brain-damaged kids, but both different dangers at pools, but the same result, and really dealing with the same tragedy that we have throughout this country of child drownings that happen really a lot in the summer months, but throughout the year.
And of course, the goal as a trial lawyer is not only to represent your client and make sure that they are properly compensated and as made whole again as possible, but in these cases, it's just not possible. But you're also going for the societal change. As you said, it had been ignored by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, other state and federal authorities. But there was a case afterwards where you were finally able to achieve that lasting difference. Tell us about that.
Sure. You know, if you remember, Senator John Edwards, who later ran for president, handled a case in Raleigh, North Carolina, where a young girl named Valerie Lakey was, she was eviscerated on a pool drain. And that was several years before Lorenzo Peterson. And so, you know, when we saw what had happened there, and after Lorenzo's case, we went to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. I actually testified at a number of their meetings, and we could not get the pool industry to do anything, even though the jury in our case, and later the appellate court, found that the pool pump had a product defect. It didn't have a suction vacuum relief device, which would simply, once the suction became to a level that is, you know, just makes no sense to the machine, it shuts it off. Lorenzo would have been saved. Other children would have been saved throughout time. The Consumer Product Safety Commission wouldn't mandate this change to pool pumps. Then a young girl by the name of Virginia Grammy Baker up in Alexandria, Virginia, she was at a sixth grade graduation party at a private residential home. She got stuck in a jacuzzi with several other kids there on the bottom of the jacuzzi drain. And she died with 30 people in attendance, all trying to help her. And her grandfather was the former Secretary of State, James Baker. And we had the privilege to be involved in that case. And from the outset, we kind of knew this was a unique opportunity. This was an opportunity to go to Congress. Then we had President George W. Bush, and obviously the relationship between the Bushes and the Bakers was very, very close. And after Grammy's case and getting it resolved, we went right to Congress. And we were able to pass the Virginia Grammy Baker Pool Safety Act, which basically requires that if pools do not have two different main drains, that can make it safe, because if somebody, God forbid, gets stuck on one drain, they'd be released by the the mechanism of the other drain, that they would indeed have to have a suction vacuum relief device on the pump. And since that time, and that when that went into law, we have only had one suction entrapment in the United States of America, and that's over 10 years. And so it's been incredibly gratifying to handle a tragic case like that and know that that family's efforts, Lorenzo's family's efforts, Valerie Lakey's family's efforts, all the families that have tried to do something, it finally amounted to a law that has made an incredible difference in the safety of children's lives throughout America.
Negligent security cases have been an emerging practice for you and your firm. You've now handled about 175 plus cases with verdicts and settlements into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Tell us about that. How did you get into that? And how's that impacted your practice?
Well, it's really impacted our practice. You know, we, like a lot of lawyers, we had handled the occasional negligent security case and started to get very involved with, you know, victims of crime organizations, because when you're a victim of crime, it's something that is very different than a lot of cases that personal injury and wrongful death lawyers handle, because someone intentionally did this to them. You know, someone not only maybe caused them to be injured in a physical way, but there's always a mental component to these cases. When we started handling them, we certainly understood that component and knew that these clients were different. But then we handled a particular case where a young man by the name of Sammy Barak was out at a nightclub one evening, and it was in a shopping center. And while he was leaving in the parking lot, he was approached by a gunman who tried to carjack him and shot him in the neck, and he was rendered a quadriplegic. And Sammy worked on a cruise line, so he was able to stay here for 1 year and get medical care. And then the cruise line shipped him off, and they shipped him back home to Tunisia, where he basically was put in a room to die. He was given no more respiratory therapy, no physical therapy, because they simply don't have that in countries like Tunisia. And we took on his case, and the nightclub had no insurance. And the case became all about the prior crimes in that parking lot and how the shopping center really did nothing about it. They had no security guard patrolling that lot. They didn't have any type of security plan. They had over 26 violent crimes against persons, and they really did nothing. They just relied on the nightclub. And the reason that case was tried was because the shopping center was just going to blame the nightclub and say it's all their fault, and hoping to get 90 or 100% liability on them. And we tried that case, and the case resulted in a $100 million verdict where there was no percentage of fault on the nightclub. And once that verdict got out there and you went through the press and the media, we were inundated with negligent security cases, not only in Florida, but from around the country. And so it certainly changed our practice. And, you know, what we kind of devoted ourselves to doing then is, you know, these cases can be prevented. You know, you're not going to stop all crime, but if you pay attention to the types of crimes that are happening at your establishment or your commercial property and you enact reasonable security measures, you can stop a lot of crime. So what we started doing handling all these cases is with each case, we would go to a different group and talk to them about how you can prevent these cases. So I've talked now for over a decade to the American Society of Industrial Security, which is the biggest security industry in the world. And I've made presentations along with Marriott, along with Walmart, about what type of, if you don't have proper security, here's what you might be facing. You might be facing a $100 million verdict. And why don't you get ahead of it and try to prevent it before it ever happens? And those are companies that I continue to sue to this day, unfortunately. But at some of the higher levels, they're trying to do the right thing. And we've worked with industry to try to prevent these types of things from occurring. And that's really, you know, one of the major focuses of our law practice in my firm to this day.
Well, and as you mentioned, that was another $100 million plus case. That one and the two near drownings were all within 5 years of each other, all when you as a lawyer were in your mid-30s. That's pretty heady stuff. I mean, where do you go from there after that sort of winning spree?
Well, that's a lot of people ask me. They say, I haven't had one in a while, so what have I been doing? But
that's the problem, right? What do you...
Well, you know, I think, you know, one thing is, you know, those were unique cases. I mean, from a lot of different aspects. I mean, you really start with just the catastrophic injuries that Lauren, Lorenzo, and Sammy all suffered. I mean, those, the life care plans in those cases were, you know, whether they were $20, $30, $40 million, they were all significant life care plans. And, you know, they're, pain and suffering and their loss of the capacity to enjoy life really shone through in those cases to those juries. And another thing I will tell you is in each one of those cases, the defense gave us a bit of a gift. In each one of those, they argued that the plaintiff had a reduced life expectancy. So believe it or not, the defense lawyers would get up there in front of a jury and say, well, Mr. Haggard's put up a life care plan that will go through 60 years of Lauren's life, but our doctors say Lauren may only live 5 years, and therefore you don't need $60 million to take care of her, $50 million, you only need five. And when a defendant does that, and the jury, as we know, you know, the research shows us that juries make preliminary decisions very early, maybe after jury selection or certainly after opening statement. If the jury's not with you on liability, and you're trying to say, give the plaintiff only a couple years of medical care because we hurt them so badly, that's not a good mix. And in each one of those cases, that is one of the theories that the defendant tried to convince a jury of. So I'll always believe that had to have some impact on the verdicts in those cases. Not to say those cases aren't worth every bit of $100 million. They are. But I think sometimes you've got to have a little luck and you've got to have the defense when they go all out. If they don't win, there's going to be repercussions with that.
Mike, let's go back and start from the beginning. What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
Well, my father has been a trial lawyer for over 50 years. And you know, growing up, you know, it was really the stories of the clients that always impacted me at the dinner table or when I would work in high school over the summer at the firm, and just seeing the relationships that my dad and his partners had with the clients. It wasn't, you know, hey, this case settled for $1 million, or, you know, at one time my dad had the biggest verdict in the history of the country in a paralysis case called Greg Stead versus Rydell, where a young high school football player was injured during a football game and was paralyzed. And my dad and his partners at the time brought a courageous case against Rydell, the helmet manufacturer. And they won a $5.3 million verdict back in 1974, which at the time was the biggest verdict in the country. But it wasn't that it was the biggest verdict or the numbers. It was his relationship with Greg Stead that lasted until Greg passed away. That always was amazing to me, that you could use your ability to persuade people to be a great public speaker and do those things, but at the end of the day, you're doing it for, you know, someone who's come on really tough times, and you have that incredible relationship where they're relying upon you. And so I just, you know, that really is what swayed me early on, that I wanted to be able to help people. I wanted to have meaningful relationships in doing that. And so my dad was my earliest mentor, obviously, and never pushed me towards it. But when I was in college, I was a communications major, and I knew I wanted to be a public speaker. I wanted to persuade people. I wanted to debate. So when I went to law school, obviously, that led me to being a trial lawyer.
Now, you were an FSU undergrad, University of Miami Law School. You spent some time as a assistant public defender there in Miami-Dade County. You had a few years in some small practices. Tell us the decision-making that led you to join your father's firm, where you are now the managing partner.
Yeah, you know, I started at the public defender's office. It was the greatest experience I've ever had. And I tell young lawyers all the time, if you have an opportunity to be a public defender, be a state attorney, you got to take that opportunity, because the ability to try cases at that rate and to be in court every single day, you can't replace that. And I loved every single minute of it. Got to try 26 cases in a year and a half. I mean, it was amazing. And, you know, then I went and worked for Don Russo, who truly was one of my just incredible mentors I was so lucky to work for, who just taught me everything about preparation and hard work and how you just had to outwork your opponent at every aspect of the case. And I learned so much from Don. And, you know, one day I went to lunch with my dad's partner at the time, Bob Parks, who I had clerked for and known all my life. And Bob just looked at me as I was starting to bring in cases to Don and was starting to become a little bit of a rainmaker. You know, Bob said, "Why are we competing against each other?" And so really it was Bob who, you know, convinced me to come over and practice with him and my dad. And, you know, I kind of always thought that is what I would do, but I never had a plan to do it. And so it was interesting that Bob, who also became an incredible mentor of mine, was basically said, "Why are we competing against each other? Let's do this together." And I got to try cases with Bob and then just one of the thrills of my career certainly was trying cases with my dad.
Well, and you have a funny story about working a case with your dad, don't you?
Sure. Yeah. You know, we were trying Lauren Hinton's case up in Broward County, and we were staying at, you know, one of the hotels up there. And, you know, it was a 2-week trial. So it was Thursday night getting ready to do closings the next day. And I think I was doing the first close and my dad was going to do rebuttal. And yeah, I woke up at 3:30 in the morning. You know, you can't sleep. You're just thinking about, you know, you're so juiced up to give your closing. So I'm walking, you know, around the hotel, the floor, because I'm pacing and I'm going through my closing. I'll never forget. I came around a corner and I bump right into my dad, who's doing the same thing. And we're the only two people. We're, you know, in our pajamas at 3:30 in the morning of this hotel doing our closings together. So it was kind of show we're cut from the same cloth a little bit. Yeah. So it was, you know, just to hold the client's hand together as a family. And we often said it was always our family, you know, helping out another family. And that's one thing that's interesting about our law firm is every lawyer there talks about being part of the family. And a lot of judges and opposing counsel, you'll hear them in trial or mediation saying, "Okay, well, we have the Haggards on one side, and my dad or I aren't even involved in the case." They call it that because it's kind of been our mantra that everybody's part of the family together. So it's, you know, I think that's why we've had a group that's been together so long.
I know that's got to be one of your keys to success, but looking back so far on your career to date, is there any one thing that you can really pin on your key to your success?
I think it all goes back to something that Don always taught me, which is it's all about preparation. I mean, you have to painstakingly prepare at every moment. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of just the lineage of the trial lawyers that we've been blessed to have in the FJA. And it always goes back to, you know, the Perry Nichols firm and J.B. Spence, who came out of that firm. And I was fortunate enough growing up in Miami to get to know J.B. really well. He always taught me that if you're not willing to roll up your sleeves and sit on the kitchen floor of your client's house and understand who your client is and really feel that in your heart and then outwork everyone else, then you should not be a trial lawyer. And it was very interesting because when I was getting ready to go to law school, and even when I was looking for a job out of law school, I was fortunate enough to meet with folks like Larry Stewart or Chris Searcy and J.B. Spence. And all they ever told me was, "Are you going to work harder than everybody else?" Because they kind of looked at me a little bit like, well, you know, Andy Haggard's his dad. Is he going to be one of those type guys and think, you know, this is easy and he's got an easy road because it's my dad? And it was very interesting to see the stern face of a Chris Searcy looking at you saying, "Are you going to work harder than everybody else or not?" And I just think that rapport we have as trial lawyers in the state of Florida and that those connections and looking out for the standard of what we all really strive for is something that has always been instilled in me. I would never want to let down the standard that, you know, not only my dad has set or Bob Parks or Don Russo, but really what I call the forefathers of our group, the Perry Nichols of the world and the Bill Frades of the world. You know, I feel a connection to them that if I'm going to have this privilege to represent people in a courtroom, I better uphold the standard that they fought so hard to preserve for us.
Do you still get nervous before a trial?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you don't have butterflies, then you've been doing it too long and you need to hang it up. That'd be the first sign to me that, you know, I didn't want to work as hard or didn't want to prepare as hard. So I almost welcome those butterflies. It's funny, I get them earlier in a trial more, you know, obviously voir dire, maybe a little bit of opening. And then once everything's going, you know, before closing, it's not butterflies. It's like an adrenaline that I have to calm myself down or I may, you know, shoot through the roof of the courthouse. So you have to control yourself a little bit.
Mike, your firm has earned more than $1 billion in verdicts and settlements over the years to date. Nevertheless, no lawyer can win every single case. How do you handle disappointment?
You know, you always learn more from your losses than your wins. I'm very self-critical. So, you know, any trial I have, I go back through and find, even I don't care whether it was the Hinton case or the Peterson case, we still make mistakes. But it's tougher to self-evaluate there because you're certainly going to celebrate. You're certainly the first thing I do after any trial is I go see my client if they weren't fortunate enough to be in the courtroom with us or spend that time, you know, just to rejoice and you know, to help them get through the next phase. So losses give you a unique opportunity. I mean, they're horrible. They're absolutely horrible, especially the high stakes that we practice at. But they do give you a unique opportunity to self-reflect and try to get better. You know, but there's tremendous pressure on us as plaintiff trial lawyers. I mean, you know, I'll never forget with Sammy Brock. I mean, I knew if we didn't win that case, he was going to die. I mean, he had fishing line tied around his tracheal tube that had not been changed since he left Jackson Memorial Hospital and flew to Tunisia. It'd been 3 years to which every doctor said there's how that's staying in place is unbelievable. And we airlifted him after that verdict. And we were fortunate to get the case resolved shortly after the verdict. And we air ambulanced him from Sousse, Tunisia to Miami, where I was there when he rolled through and went right into the operating room. And the great doctors at JMH, I mean, in 45 minutes, had his trach replaced. And we knew then and there we'd saved his life. But, you know, when that jury was out, all you're thinking about is the flip side. If I lose this case, he's going to die. His life is literally in my hands. And so, you know, you can't deny that pressure. But at the same time, you know, you're given the opportunity to help someone like that. So it's an incredible opportunity that you've got to take as serious as you possibly can.
And you have some very personal experience yourself with life or death moments.
Yeah, I and my family runs a disease called polycystic kidney disease, PKD. And you know, I was diagnosed. You mentioned I got those verdicts in my mid-30s, and I was diagnosed in my early 30s. And I was fortunate that I didn't have a lot of symptoms. I lived life the same as everybody else does, but knew that time was ticking, that I would need a kidney transplant. And when it came upon that time, I was incredibly fortunate that my wife's brother, Alan Buchholz, who's actually a Black Hawk pilot in the United States Army, was a match. And and I was transplanted on October 6th of 2016. And, you know, what's ironic about that is talking about how close trial lawyers are in Florida, you know, at least 15 different trial lawyers came forward to be a donor to me. And I didn't really, you know, seek that either. And it was just amazing just how hard these folks fight for their clients, but at the same time were willing to save my life. And I was very fortunate. I never was on dialysis. And literally, you know, a month or two after that was back practicing law and knock on wood and able to do everything. Tried 2 cases last year. But at the same time that I've returned back to normal, it breaks my heart and my wife's heart every day where, you know, you see folks going on dialysis or worse, waiting for a kidney and dying on the kidney list where they don't really know that they can go get a living donor. So, you know, we funded a position at Tampa General Hospital where I was transplanted that the person's sole job, the staff member there, is to find living donors for possible transplant recipients. And we've been able to increase living donation at TGH by more than 77% since that position's been in place. So it's very gratifying to know that we can make that difference in people's lives.
Along the way in your career, you have won many awards. You're a member of the top 100 trial lawyers, regularly featured on Florida Trends Legal Elite. Your involvement with the Florida Justice Association, you're a past president. You're the recipient of both a Silver and a Golden Eagle Award. You have won the Perry Nichols Award, which is the FJA's most prestigious award given to an attorney whose perseverance, commitment, and unmatched dedication to the civil justice system is at the forefront of their lives. Did you know Perry Nichols? He was from Miami.
I did not. My dad did. But I have a, when I was, you know, just amazed to win that award. I was fortunate enough to show everybody there something that I have, which I kind of call my secret sauce, which Bob Parks gave me, which is a notebook that contains notes from the firm meetings, lawyers meetings, internal seminars that the Nichols firm had. And so I've got original notes of Perry Nichols, of Bill Frates, of J.B. Spence, of all these, the really, I mean, just the forefathers of our practice. And it's in their handwriting, you know, nothing's typed. And it's something that I always read before I start trial. There's sections on opening statement, and you could be in the most fancy reptile seminar in the world, and the bedrock of everything everybody's talking about is in that notebook. And so I never got the opportunity to meet Perry, but he's certainly one of my heroes. But you know, really, one thing that I talked about that day is if you look at not only the great law firms that we have throughout the state of Florida, but really if you look at all the offshoots of solo practitioners, smaller firms, you can trace many of these firms back to that original firm. And it's really amazing when you kind of look at that. And I think that's the reason we have by far the strongest state trial lawyer organization in the FJA, because the collegiality between us is really amazing. It's why we've done so well in the legislature, why we won those battles. And it all dates back to the Nichols firm.
How important is it to give back to the FJA, especially the foundation that focuses on research and education, toward your point of lasting change?
You know, I have a saying, and I'm sure I stole it from somebody, that if you have the privilege to stand up in a courtroom and represent a client, then you have the responsibility to go to the legislature and fight for those clients' rights. You know, without the FJA, we wouldn't have a legal practice. We would not have a tort system in the state of Florida. We have faced insurmountable odds. And because of the FJA, because of the law firms that have supported it for so long, because of all the lawyers and the clients that have gotten re-engaged and fought those battles, that's why we're here today. And we're fortunate to practice in a state that we have limitations and we have some bad laws on the book. But when compared to the rest of the country, you know, we have fared very, very well. And ironically, so is our business community. So it kind of shows that you can coexist, that the arguments of tort reform are really misplaced, because we have a business environment in Florida that's the envy of most businesses. And we also have a tort system that works generally for our clients. So if you are a trial lawyer and you're handling personal injury and wrongful death cases in Florida, you have to be a member of the FJA. Not just because it's the right thing to do, but because you're a member of a bigger law firm. You're part of a listserv that you can ask on a moment's notice, you know, hey, does anybody have a complaint for this type of case, or an expert in this type of case? And you can get it right off the listserv within moments, which is just the same thing as walking down, you know, the hall to your partner, your associate, and asking the same question, except for you're asking 3,000 people at once. And not to mention, you know, all the seminars, the networking, and all the advantages that the FJA brings to make us really one big law firm working together on behalf of our clients.
Mike, trial law is a tough profession, huge demand on time, energy. You have a family, a wife, a son, a daughter. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
Yeah, it's tough, you know, and early on, I would say that I probably did not do as good as a job as I could have. You know, when I was, you know, thinking back to when I was not only trying the Hinton, the Peterson, and the Brock cases and a bunch of others, I was also coming up through the FJA. And the FJA and the executive committee, when you're an officer, is tremendously time consuming. And so it's very tough. And you've got to carve out time. You've got to figure out, you know, what your firm is like and how you can share responsibilities. You know, I was fortunate, you know, having early success that I could start to delegate some things at my firm. And really, when I went away to be president of the FJA, that really taught me that, is that I could count on other people. And that helped me to be a better husband, a better father. And I actually took a couple of years where I coached my son's youth football team. And so you can imagine, you're leaving the office, you're going to football practice, you know, so that would limit, you know, some out-of-town trips. I had some great coaches around me. But it's funny, I took the same energy and the same principles into coaching youth football that I did practicing law and trying cases, which is all about preparation. I mean, people would always joke with me. I would film the other team's game. I would film our game. I would review it. And my wife would be like, are you getting ready for trial or are you getting ready for next week's game? And it could be either or. So, but it is an incredibly important balance. And one thing I think that's so important is you really got to talk to your kids and your family about what you're doing, because they certainly understand it more. You know, my kids know about them, and they know about my cases, they know about my clients, and they know how important it is to their lives. So by involving your family, I think it's very important, because they understand more when you might be away. But it's something that every trial lawyer, you know, is going to experience, because you can't be a great trial lawyer without a great work ethic. I mean, there's just no substitute. So you've got to figure out that balance.
Mike, how would you like to be remembered?
You know, for the relationships with the clients, you know, that's what motivated me to get into this practice in the first place, to be a plaintiff's trial lawyer. I know how my clients feel about me, and I know how I feel about them. And it's really, that's enough for me, you know, just to keep up that work ethic, that standard, and never let down the standard of what the FJA and our forefathers have set out. And, you know, if I can stand along them and do it like they did and make them proud, you know, that's more than enough for me.
Mike Haggard, you are a titan of trial. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for the time.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.